When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Ellie Tomsett about stand-up comedy and contemporary feminisms, sexism, stereotypes, and structural inequalities. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
This is a great book. It's incredibly important. As we're going to talk about, it speaks to a whole load of issues that are really kind of live in Britain's comedy industry, Britain's cultural and creative industries, British society, but also basically kind of comedy industries all over the globe, actually. And also, you know, kind of media industries and cultural industries in lots of other places as well. And I think the importance of the book really is well illustrated by the introduction, where you talk about the kind of the motivations, one of which I think is sort of really interesting, the way that there was real kind of hostility that I detected to the idea of writing a book about women in stand-up comedy, but then also actually a sort of a more maybe academic point about there being kind of gaps in the field. So what was this kind of starting point and the kind of motivation to write the book?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose I don't want to say it was just to prove people wrong, although obviously that feels incredible. But I think for me, I've always had a real interest in comedy as an audience member for comedy. I should make very clear at the start that I'm not a comedian, so don't expect me to be funny at any point. But I was thinking around kind of what was happening in the circuit around 2013 and thinking about how we were seeing a really clear change in some of the material that was getting shown or displayed in live arenas, but also becoming kind of critically successful. So I think we saw a kind of mirroring between the live circuit and the kind of content that women were performing there, and a wider move back towards maybe popular forms of feminism. Obviously, Sarah Bannett Weiser talks extensively around that. But I think prior to that, we'd have the kind of resistance to people claiming feminism as a word or their understandings of feminism so broadly. And then in 2013, obviously, we had Bridget Christie win the, you know, Edinburgh Best Comedy Show, formerly known as the Perrier Award, and become the third woman only to do so at that stage in its kind of history, with a show that was explicitly feminist in kind of tone and content, I suppose. So it was kind of seeing an opportunity to explore something that felt very much happening at that moment, and that wasn't very well explored in terms of the literature. There is some really excellent work on women in humour and women in comedy, but there was quite a gap between when that had been written kind of post the alternative movement of the 80s and the current kind of day. There's a lot of writing on American stand-ups and women comics, but not so much with a UK focus. So I kind of saw a gap and an opportunity to explore something that I'm really interested in and that I felt was maybe under-researched.
The book has got a whole different range of approaches, and I think one of the things that makes the book really kind of rich actually is it answers that both kind of gap and both that kind of moment that you've just described then in a variety of different ways. And I'm sort of intrigued to hear really a bit more about the participants, because perhaps, I mean, slightly unusually for an academic book, there are lots of sort of famous people in the book, which gives it a sort of a bit of, I suppose, kind of star quality, as well as being, you know, a sort of a rich academic text. And at the same time, you know, these are like working stand-ups, you know, these are working comics. So I'm intrigued to hear about the participants. And at the same time, there's a lot of stuff about the audience as well, both in terms of doing survey work with audiences, but also thinking about the places where stand-up takes place. And getting that sense of, I think, kind of methods would be a really good way to start our conversation.
Yeah, so I suppose first and foremost, we can think about it in terms of feminist ethnography, in that I was the researcher in residence with the Women in Comedy Festival in Manchester for a period of 4 years. So that kind of gave me a position from which to explore lots of different angles. So obviously, it enabled me to speak directly to performers, so women who were working within the context I was exploring, but also to observe that event, which was founded in 2013, grow and develop and kind of tackle some of the issues within the industry and start to understand maybe why these events occur, and also to engage then with the audiences and to understand what motivates audiences to go to women-only comedy events. Like, what's in it for them? What are they getting there that perhaps they aren't getting from more mainstream or mixed-gendered spaces? So yeah, being that researcher in residence enabled me to see that kind of evolution of that festival, and also to kind of be in on all of the meetings, to see the decisions get made, to really put back into the project as well. So obviously, to not just kind of go in and scoop information out on leave, but to very much embed myself in that space. So I designed their logos, I participated by designing their brochures and, you know, stacking chairs, picking up glasses at the end of events, that kind of thing. So yeah, being amongst that volunteer team for a long period kind of gave me that knowledge of how those events operate and how performers operate in those spaces as well. So, you know, it's interesting that you note that many of the women that I speak to are quite well known. They were probably less well known at the time that I was initially talking to them. So for example, with Sophie Willen, I was talking to her in the first kind of couple of years of her career. She was, you know, well versed in performance at the time, you know, had done lots of live stuff and performance of all kinds, but was starting to move towards a more kind of comic and stand-up approach, whereas obviously, you know, multiple BAFTAs under her belt now. So yeah, so I was speaking to people at different parts of their career or different periods in their career, I suppose.
I mean, you mentioned the sort of being in the room, you know, the sense of how decisions are made, and I think that's one thing that the book does incredibly well, is give a sense of both who are the kind of gatekeepers, who are the decision makers, both, you know, within the kind of booking, hiring, but also thinking about critics as well. And I think this would be a good place actually to sort of dip in to understand what some of the kind of the barriers that women face in the industry. So to kick off, like, who are the kind of the gatekeepers? Who sort of like run stand-up comedy in Britain?
Yeah, well, I suppose kind of first and foremost in a live environment, it's people like the promoters. So people who book individual comedy nights or series of comedy nights across multiple venues. Obviously, sometimes we have dedicated comedy spaces or comedy venues where you'll have maybe a promoter owner. But yeah, so in the live environment, it's very much the people who promote live events, but also perhaps the MCs might also be involved in booking lineups and so on. So those are the people who tend to be in charge in the kind of live environment. And then obviously we move between potentially that live environment and recorded environments. And obviously then we start to see the significance of large scale events, such as things like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and kind of talent scouts and producers of kind of mediated comedy forming kind of gatekeepers around there as well.
In terms of that, that system, it's clear, and, you know, I mean, I sort of assume people should know this already, but it's clear that there are really kind of significant gendered imbalances, both, you know, as you've mentioned, you know, these kind of big set piece comedy festivals, but also in terms of, you know, even sort of small scale things with sort of smaller promoters. And what are the kind of, I suppose, kind of barriers that women face to getting in to that system, and indeed getting on within that system?
Yeah, getting in and getting on, the classics. So I kind of, from the data that I collected through those performer and promoter interviews, kind of seven themes were constructed as a result of that interview data. So I think the first one, and the one that maybe potentially some women listeners will recognise, is the idea of being the only woman on a lineup. So lots of my performers or participants spoke about being booked as the woman, and therefore they didn't need any other women to be on the bill because the woman box was ticked. But then that puts that performer in the position of having to speak on behalf of an entire gender, which is obviously impossible. So kind of zero intersectional awareness on behalf of promoters, and kind of just using women as a way to tick a box rather than thinking more holistically around how that would then put them in a more complicated position than their male contemporaries by forcing them to be the woman. Also, I mean, we can think about this in relation to the kind of wider kind of industrial context. It puts women in more of a position to be exploited, because often they are working on their own amongst a male lineup, and this potentially creates an environment where exploitation is more likely to occur. So I'd say the only woman was the theme that came up the most in all of those conversations, and is becoming less and less of a thing. I think definitely in an online space, we're seeing much more calling out of tokenism or lack of inclusion in comedy lineups. But at the time, this was a kind of key topic for my interviewees. Also, just sexism. So sexist audience reactions, and also sexism from industry professionals. So what we mean by sexist, or what was meant by sexist audience reactions, was the kind of all of the kind of stereotypes we have around women and humour. The idea that women aren't funny, you know, the Christopher, as much as I didn't want to have to cite it, the Christopher Hitchens "Why Women Aren't Funny" article, you know, it was very much in the kind of public sphere, but kind of very pervasive in relation to the way that audiences respond to women comics. And Kiri Pritchard-McLean talked extensively about the kind of way that she, as she approaches a space or as she gets to the microphone, how often she feels a kind of shift in the energy in the room if they aren't necessarily expecting a woman, or they aren't open to listening to a woman, or a woman taking control of that space. And she also talked, and again, it's mentioned in the book, about her kind of negative experiences starting out from other comics, other industry professionals like journalists and promoters when starting out in kind of competitions. And so, you know, straightforward, straight up sexism is very much one of the barriers. And every time I've been giving kind of public talks on this book, which, you know, came out last summer now, I'm greeted by, you know, comics sharing horror stories in relation to sexism with me, but also telling me how much, even though the book is quite explicitly saying misogyny exists, you know, saying that they feel like I've undersold it in my talk, which is quite depressing. But like, yeah, it's definitely still, even now, a really big factor is the kind of sexism that these women encounter getting into the industry, and also remaining in the industry. And I suppose that links to another one of the themes that came out, which was poor introductions. So obviously on a kind of comedy lineup, normally you have some kind of MC or compere who provides the kind of glue between the different acts, you know, welcomes them on stage and so on. And often comics are really aware of having had quite difficult or negative introductions, and that putting them at a disadvantage before they've even reached the microphone or said their first word. Alison June Smith talked about having to do kind of additional labour to kind of speak to compares in advance to make sure that the kind of introduction they would receive would be kind of gender free. So not using things like "she is" or "you're going to love this lady," which is a classic. So trying to make sure that their introduction wasn't going to set them up to fail, basically. So I say those are the kind of key ones. But then if we start thinking about how maybe some of the solutions might also present issues as well. So another thing that came out was that obviously we've had a rise of maybe women-only comedy nights, and some of them are very badly advertised, and they're advertised in ways that both kind of foreground gender in quite a stereotypical way. So pink lips, high heels, etc., or indeed kind of phrased in ways that frame these nights as for women rather than by women. So this was seen as this particular kind of advertising, the kind of retro-sexist gender binary advertising of these kind of nights, was seen as potentially reinforcing some of those stereotypes or framing comedy by women as a genre, which obviously it isn't. You know, the comedy performed by the women featured in the book are across all of the genres, from kind of character and sketch, you know, to what would be considered more traditional standard. Then I suppose the final two, Dave, just to complete the set, we've got aesthetic pressures. So several of the women talked about having to dress in certain ways to sometimes obscure their body in ways that would prevent them being sexualized, especially when they were starting out on the circuit, feeling that they didn't want to make themselves vulnerable in that way, or vulnerable to kind of being sexualized by their audiences, but also just in general having to think about, you know, how they would look and how that would relate to normative femininity. And obviously that's additional labor that, you know, aesthetic labor is labor that women do in all types of industries, but they kind of brought that up in relation to negotiating their kind of gendered performance in that space. And then the last one, and the one that I think was most surprising to me, as somebody who doesn't kind of work traditionally in this industry, was economic disparities. So women reporting that they were being paid less for the same work. So, and when I mean same work, I mean for the same spot. So, you know, being the headliner or being the middle spot on a lineup, or being given kind of lower paying slots rather than you know, moving up into headliner spots where the remuneration is higher, or being held in that space, that middle space, for longer. Also, we have to appreciate, again, if you're in a situation where promoters or bookers will only book one woman on a bill, numerically, you know, there are less opportunities for women to build up that stage time and move through those, move up that hierarchy towards headliner. But also, you know, they have more travel costs. You know, if there are only 5 slots in Manchester that they can possibly have versus, say, 15 slots if you're a male comic, then you're going to have to travel. You're going to accrue more travel costs and having to go further away to build that stage time up. So sadly, the answer is many and varied to your question of what are the barriers. But that those were the kind of key 7 that came up as a result of the interview data.
It's worth saying as well, like, I mean, those 7 are not new. And one of the things the book does quite early on is sort of contextualize the long and pretty grim sexist history within British comedy. And also actually, you know, places it in a sort of broader context, particularly in relation to stand-up in the US. But a couple of things you flagged there about, you know, things like positions on the bill, how women are introduced by, you know, MCs and compares, thinking about things like how they feel pressured to present in particular ways, really sort of draw attention to the role of the audience. And one of the things that you've got, and again, you've talked about this already, is both the sort of ethnographic detail, but you've also got an engagement with audiences. And it'd be good to hear, I think, a bit about how audiences sort of understood women-only comedy events that you were looking at. And I guess kind of broadly, sort of more generally, what the role of the audience is in both challenging, but also in some ways kind of upholding some of those barriers you've described.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously having the opportunity to engage with an audience for a new event like the Women in Comedy Festival was great, because it's not the kind of, you know, it's not the kind of thing that gets studied very often. There is really excellent work on comedy audiences more broadly. So Sharon Lockyer and Lynn Meyer's work from 2011 was the kind of touch point for me. They'd looked at motivations to attend comedy, live comedy, more broadly. But I wanted to kind of narrow that down to think, you know, what is the additional reasons, or are there additional reasons why people might attend women-only spaces? So things that came out from the kind of audience data, both through surveys and through follow-up interviews, was that often many audience members were attending these spaces because they had negative experiences in mainstream spaces, or they had gone and either experienced misogyny from the comics on stage in mainstream spaces, or potentially felt that maybe some of the audience were kind of giving that misogyny as part of kind of heckling and so on. So interestingly, a lot of the audiences or respondents framed women-only comedy nights as kind of alternative to those mainstream spaces, and they were anticipating experiencing maybe a slightly more feminist or slightly more inclusive comedy that wouldn't necessarily have the same levels of misogyny experienced in those mainstream spaces. And I think this again speaks, thinking back to Sarah Bannett Wise's argument about popular feminisms, obviously she's talking about that becoming present at the same time as we have popular misogyny. So I think we are seeing that reflected quite a lot in the material performed by cis men on the kind of mainstream stage. So I think that was kind of interesting. Like, it's often framed as, I'm going here because I'm not getting my needs met by these mainstream spaces. But also, very interestingly, from my perspective, is that there was occasionally the audience members who had attended the Women Only Comedy Festival, you know, using quite stereotypical language in some of their responses, some holding very conservative views around kind of gender roles and the kind of comedy that maybe pushes back against kind of male dominance, and then seeing that very much as if it's kind of man-hating, or kind of all of those words that we would use around kind of push back against feminism, I suppose, or backlash against feminism. And why that's particularly interesting to me is that I think we have this, and again, this is probably quite a well-used phrase, but this idea that things like women-only comedy spaces will be preaching to the converted, that the people in those audiences will maybe have more enlightened understandings of gender equality, or will be going there in some kind of role as supporter of women. But that didn't seem to be the case from some of the responses I got from those interviews, that there were definitely people in that audience, or those audiences for the events I surveyed and interviewed for, that did have quite regressive views about what women were capable of in relation to comedy. So in relation to what the purpose of the festival might be, then, is that actually that's kind of weirdly good news for them, because it's showing that they are making a difference. They're not just getting people, or bums on seats with people that are already on board with this idea of kind of gender equality in comedy. They are also, you know, exposing people who wouldn't normally come in contact with women comics to a variety of comedy from a variety of women. So I think those are the kind of key things from the audience work, and you know, women only nights being positioned as alternative, and also potentially being a space where stereotypical views can be more challenged. So yeah, those were the kind of key findings there.
I mean, we'll get into the I guess kind of backlash stuff a little bit later, perhaps towards the end of the podcast, both actually from other comedians, but also thinking more broadly about the idea of comedy as a workplace with particular rules that really aren't very well applied. But before that, thinking, I suppose, a bit on the backlash theme, there's this question about social media. And one of the things that I suppose we see argued is the idea of social media makes comics that are, you know, maybe previously struggling to find an audience more discoverable, more visible. But at the same time, you know, we know that social media is basically like just a horrible pit of hatred and awfulness, and which, you know, because of various platform owners, seems to be getting worse. And it was fascinating, I suppose, the way your participants, I guess, like negotiated social media on the one hand, you know, seeing kind of some elements of it being useful, but also it'd be good to get a sense of how social media actually reinforced the longstanding sexism and kind of gender inequality in comedy.
Yeah, so I mean, I think let's start with the positives. Why not? So, you know, in a positive sense, you know, social media has provided a much more accessible platform to expose a wider audience to the kinds of humour that you as a comic might be, you know, doing in a live environment, to give audiences a sense of the kind of humour that you have. It also potentially is a showcase of your kind of user-generated content, you know, to potential bookers, to people who might be able to progress your career in some way. But it also provides quite a unique opportunity to interact with the audience outside the physical space of live comedy. Now, that's pretty unique in that, you know, if you went and did a set and it bombed spectacularly, you know, you might bump into the odd person at the bar afterwards, but then you could physically remove yourself from that and then get on with your life and pick yourself back up. Whereas with social media, you do have exposure, perhaps is the word I'm looking for, to people's opinions of how that went for you, if you go looking for it, I suppose. Basically, you also can build up more of a kind of two-way relationship with audiences. You know, quite a lot of the analysis I do in the book, I suppose, is to think about how it might be used to expose some of the labour of stand-up comedy that's traditionally hidden. So we have comics kind of tweeting along their stand-up tour and the difficulties of, you know, being on the road for so long, or the logistics of being trapped outside a venue, or those kind of things. So it builds up more of an interpersonal relationship with their audiences, I suppose. So it can be really useful. And also, we can also see it as a really good way of exposing bad practice, you know, in line with the wider kind of Me Too use of social media. And we have seen several women move very successfully between social media forms and onto mediated comedy, but also into kind of the live arena. I mean, Rosie Holt's a good example, which I think I use in the book, where kind of during the pandemic, their pretend Tory MP was very much a present feature of the kind of Twitter timeline, and now, you know, are kind of replicating that in a live environment. And I think that's quite unique to the UK as well, in the sense of, because we're quite a small, geographically small space in comparison to, say, the USA, you know, there is a direct opportunity for people to see people live in the way that, you know, because the US is so vast, it might not translate as directly into physical people on seats for a live tour, whereas in the UK it's slightly different, I think. There's probably more potential for that. However, I think the thing that often gets missed in this discussion of social media as the solution to some of these barriers in the old school circuit is that women, you know, disproportionately experience you know, online misogyny, online hate, and again, any kind of intersectional characteristic here would add to that. I mean, we know that, you know, Black women especially experience a lot of kind of misogyny online. But again, this is additional labour that women in this industry are having to undertake. They're having to negotiate potential hostilities in a way that potentially their, you know, their cis male colleagues may not be experiencing. However, we also know that male comics also, you know, have highlighted how bad social media can be for their mental health. James Acaster very famously pushing back against being on social media. But I think it's also that additional burden of those gender stereotypes that maybe feed into some of that online, some of those online exchanges, that can just make it, you know, really exhausting.
The book closes with a sort of consideration of the Me Too moment in comedy. And one of the things that's always quite tricky about an in-depth and sort of long-term ethnographic project is you are sort of slightly at the mercy of events. So I'm sure, you know, there was a kind of moment where it's like, well, you know, my project has to respond to this. And indeed, you know, the project is really kind of well-placed, I think, to speak directly to the Me Too moment in comedy. And one of the things I was intrigued by, and this has come up actually, you know, in what you were describing in terms of social media and thinking about gatekeepers and also audiences, is the sense that comedy is a workplace. I mean, it's probably, you know, slightly unusual to think of comedy as a job. Mm. And I suppose particularly stand-up is constructed as, like, you know, almost the exact opposite to being a job. You know, it has this kind of sense of it's not working in an office, it's not 9 to 5, you know, it's not kind of traditional manual labor or whatever. And I'm sort of interested to know a bit about how Me Too impacted comedy in the UK, but whether there have been any changes. So, for example, you know, you were talking about access to venues, about how women present themselves on stage, even the kind of humor that they'll, you know, sort of draw on, or the subjects they might cover. What's been the impact of Me Too on comedy as that sense of being a place where people work?
Mm. Well, I think there has been a lot of initiatives, you know, set up in an attempt to tackle some of this. And I think it links directly to the kind of informality of comedy as a workplace. And we know that that's an issue across the creative industries. And obviously Me Too, in many ways, disproportionately focused on all the largest stories that got the most coverage were within the entertainment industries. And we know that, you know, obviously when you've got spaces that are about who you know, then obviously, again, you're kind of open to wider exploitation. But things like Get Off Live Comedy, which was an initiative set up by Kiri Pritchard-McLean and Nina Gilligan, which again was around kind of providing a HR department for comedy because it doesn't have one. So a space to maybe report and get support and also guidance for people setting up new spaces. as well. But I think that thing around comedy as a workplace, I think as somebody, again, somebody relatively external to comedy as an industry, I think sometimes it's easy to forget that these people are working and that this is their workplace. And I think there are specifics about that workplace that leave comedy kind of additionally exposed to things like sexual abuse and sexual misconduct, in that it kind of feeds into that wider issue of the just joking defence, in that, you know, if a boundary is crossed in a, say, a green room environment, you know, the default setting of exchanges in those kind of spaces is informality, is joking, is humour. So often that can obscure or hide when a boundary is crossed with somebody. But also if somebody pushes back against behaviour that they think is out of line or they think is, you know, misconduct, then often they're met with, "I was just joking." Well, that means something different in comedy than it does to, say, me as an academic. You know, my job is not to be funny. You know, that's not anything about my professional identity. Whereas if you're accused of not being able to take a joke, which is what that is, that speaks directly to a woman's, you know, a woman comic's professional identity. It's saying you aren't equipped. Not only do I think you've misunderstood this interpretation, or you've misinterpreted my intentions, but also this speaks to your ability to be a comedian. And also the person potentially pushing back on that, you know, is a male comic who has a business card which says that they're a comedian. So when they say it's a joke, you feel differently about that to, you know, if it was in any other industry, I suppose. So it's that environment of informality, the who you know-ness of being able to get spots and get booked and so on, but also the way that the just joking, the just joking aspects, the way of kind of obscuring sexual misconduct behind humour operates very specifically in a comic environment. So I think there is more awareness of that. We also have the Live Comedy Association, who again are attempting to make changes more broadly to live comedy in the UK, and to make it a safer place for women and non-binary comics to operate. We also had various other kind of initiatives win praise and support, and one of the Edinburgh panel prizes, I think, went to the Get Home Safe Collective, which was Angela Barnes and Samina Vzera. They were looking at getting women and non-binary comics home safely after gigs, and that was in response to the death of Eurydice Dixon, an Australian comic travelling home after working late at night. So there's much more awareness of it as an issue. Has it made a ton of difference? I'm not sure. I think we might have to wait and see how that plays out. But there's definitely efforts to make changes. But again, I want to really highlight that those efforts are being made by people currently disenfranchised by the system. So it's never people with the power. I think this is a bit overarching theme of the book. It's never people with the power in the existing system that is doing the work of changing it. You know, it's people like Hazel O'Keefe setting up the Women in Comedy Festival, or Laughing Cows, or Lynn Parker of Funny Women, or Jessica Toomey of The Frog and Bucket, or Kiri Pritchard McLean and Nina Gilligan of Get Off Live Comedy doing that work. You know, or Sophie Duca running Wacky Racists to specifically highlight, you know, the lack of opportunity for women of colour and people of colour in the comedy circuit. So the people doing that labour, that additional work to make these changes, are the people who are disenfranchised by that current system, because nobody ever likes to give up power, right? Like, it's going to be a long time before people down their tools and say, "I've had enough of power, over to you." So I think that's and that's a very long answer to your question, but things are happening. There's much more awareness, but it's probably too soon to know kind of the consequences of that.
And that really is the sort of closing moment of the book. And there's various sort of other things we could have looked at that's in the book. There's quite a lot of discussion about basically quite badly behaved men, and indeed how some of them have profited actually from claiming to be part of a backlash against even modest gains for women in comedy. And there is consideration of things like the content of some of the stand-up routines from the comics you were working with. But to wrap up with, I'm sort of intrigued as to where your own work is going next, because there's a really obvious kind of next book as a research agenda that follows from this one, precisely tracking what you've just described in terms of how things are changing in the industry. But at the same time, I can imagine having done, you know, sort of such a long term study that you might have reached the point where you're a bit like, I'd like to do something else entirely now. So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm definitely not comedied out. I think still very interested in continuing to engage with comedy, hoping to do some work around kind of new technologies in the live comedy environment and how those technologies maybe change that relationship between audience and performer. I've just been working on an edited collection with colleagues, Natalie Weidhasser and Poppy Wild, Working Women on Screen, which was specifically about representations of paid labour. And my contribution to that book was looking at the creative industry, so representations within fiction of creative industry workplaces in relation to kind of gender dynamics. So I think in the foreseeable, I'm going to stick with that for a little bit, but definitely kind of looking more at the kind of live comedy environment in the long term. Because there's, like you say, so much more to be uncovered and explore.